With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, working to better understand chill accumulation in pistachio trees. But we start today with a conversation on bee health. I'm talking with Omar Davidi, co-founder and CEO of Bee Hero. To start, tell us a little bit about Bee Hero.
From we look at the fact that, you know, majority of crops out there requires bee pollination, you know, to produce outputs. And the bee situation is not great. You know, it's stuck with a colony collapse disorder and some of the environmental aspects that we see affect the ability to maintain strong and healthy colonies. And eventually that translates to farmers that need to get pollination and not necessarily getting the quality and the quantity of bees that they need to ensure the process is done, you know, in a most efficient and optimized way. So we developed small low-cost sensors that goes into beehives, and they stay in those hives all year long. We are tracking and monitoring the beehives activity and providing insights to the beekeepers all year long to make sure that they can maintain stronger and healthier colonies. And as it comes to the bloom time for, you know, certain crops, we can ensure that the hives being deployed in the field will provide the coverage that you need for the pollination timeframe.
As you said, bloom time, it's a very important time for a lot of the Central Valley crops in California, with a lot of nut crops that are blooming, some fruit crops that are blooming. It's a big pollination time. That's, in fact, our almond orchards are known for their pollination seasons. So how does something like Bee Hero help out with that? And especially in a year like this, where we've had some weather that could be damaging, what can we expect?
So as you mentioned, this is in a way probably the largest pollination event in the world, you know, having more than 1 million acres that needs to be pollinated and millions of hives going across the country to come here to California and provide pollination. Bee Hero today is taking quite a significant role in it. We are practically the largest pollination provider in the States and also in Australia, but looking into what's happening now, more than 10% of the hives in the industry are working with Bee Hero, having our sensors inside and providing pollination. I think you touched a super important point. Sorry about that. You're touching a very important point, which is, you know, weather become less and less predictable in a way. And we've seen it last year with, you know, snow during the bloom time in Central Valley, which was quite an odd scenery. And this year, you know, seeing very cold weather, a lot of rain coming early on. And as we get those unpredicted weather, and also more extreme weather, it makes the process of pollination even more significant or more important, because you have shorter period of time to pollinate billions and trillions of flowers. And if you're not well equipped with the quality of bees and the pollination force that you need, shortening the time frame for pollination can make a significant impact either on quality or the quantity of the outputs. And that's something that, you know, can take you from being a profitable business to, you know, losing money. And that's where it becomes more and more critical.
A lot of the beekeepers who bring in bees for the almond bloom are actually bringing in bees from other states. And so there's a lot of stress on the bees. Does something like this help when it comes to bee stress to keep them a little bit more productive?
So the lot of risk associated with, you know, the beekeeping business in general, it's a migratory business, as you mentioned. They come out of states to California for almond pollination, and then they might go to, you know, Washington State for apple pollination and continue maybe to berry pollination and some of the row crops. So you're basically constantly moving, and that, of course, puts more stress into those bees, and you have to make sure that you address it in a thoughtful and smart way. I guess our work with the beekeepers, the fact that it starts, you know, before pollination, is where we can will survive those trips. You know, sometimes you have weak hives that you better maintain where they are now and help to build them up so you can, use them later on to pollinate other crops or to produce honey. But if you put them on tracks now, they might not be able to even survive the trip. Sometimes, you know, during those logistical efforts, you encounter situations like the border control and other things that might affect the bees. And being able to track the bees on the go and be able to support them and treat them better as they arrive to the certain locations definitely helps. And, you know, almond is probably the most challenging one in terms of pollination because it's just out of the overwintering period where the bees are basically hibernating and now they need to build up for pollination and you want to get good and strong bees ready to pollinate when the bloom kicks in. So every small thing that you can support in this process and, you know, give data to the beekeepers who knows what to do, just providing them better tools to do it, helps a lot to the entire ecosystem, to the beekeeping industry, together with the crop growers who needs those bees in the best possible way.
You can hear our full conversation online at agnetwest.com. This is the Agnet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more of the day's agriculture news. You're listening to the Agnet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, USDA's first agricultural trade mission of the year provided both official dialogue and sales opportunities focused on an African market. Rod Bain has more.
The Agriculture Department's first ag trade mission in 2024 is in the books.
This was my first time leading an agribusiness trade mission, and I was pleased to have many U.S. exporters, cooperators, representatives from Kansas and Wisconsin join us as we work on expanding U.S. food and agriculture products and exports to Angola.
Agriculture Deputy Secretary Sochil Torres-Small in an end-of-mission callback to reporters from Africa. She notes the significance of this particular event and provides the rundown of those represented in the delegation.
In all, we had 9 U.S. companies, State Department of Agriculture representatives, and 8 USDA cooperators join us for the first ever trade mission to Angola.
Like previous ag trade missions, there were meetings by U.S. government officials with counterparts from Angola.
We discussed ways to overcome barriers to trade and also mutual interest in mitigating climate change impacts on agriculture, food security, and local food production.
And face-to-face meetings between sellers of U.S. ag products and commodity organizations representing them and buyers from Angola and neighboring nations.
I got the chance to meet with businesses the first time to Angola for many of them. And most of them came in ready to explore new markets. They actually ended up leaving with sales, resulted in over 120 business-to-business meetings. And currently, they're reporting over $18 million in projected 12-month sales. That's a big number. In fact, it's the highest we've had in Africa for an agribusiness trade mission ever. And it's the third highest period post-COVID.
Among the members of the U.S. delegation, Matt Copeland. He's the African representative to the U.S. Meat Export Federation.
From our side, Angola is an important market. It has gone through some challenges, but in terms of developed customer base, developed importer base, and people that we already know and trust and have trading histories with, there are a few in that market who have been incumbent there for quite a long time. They have a wide disparity in terms of wealth. There are certainly a lot of folk who can afford some of the best beef in the world.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The COVID-19 pandemic impacted retail sales of organic food products over time. After reaching record sales in 2020, organics then saw the first ever decline in sales in 2021. USDA research economist Sharon Skorbianski explained at the USDA Ag Outlook Forum, sales also declined in 2022.
2022 sales are higher than those pre-pandemic, showing that while they were impacted, demand is still strong. Sales by food categories. Organic fruits and vegetables are still the most popular category, making up 35% of the market and almost reaching $23 billion in 2022. Dairy and eggs is the second most popular category, and it surpassed $8 billion in 2022.
Despite the declines since the pandemic high, organic sales are still strong. That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, though cattle inventories have tightened and prices continue to climb, beef still holds its place on the table.
We're still seeing relatively tight cattle and beef supplies and strong prices.
That's Mark Jekinowski, USDA Outlook Board Chairman, whose team of analysts just increased the beef demand forecast by 140 million pounds. Along with an increase in demand for beef, steer prices are
very strong. We raised our steer price forecast by $2.50 per hundredweight, currently at $182.50 per hundredweight. That's up almost $7 per hundredweight year over year, and reflects still very strong consumer demand despite very high beef prices.
In other livestock news,
the Packers and Stockyards Act prohibits discrimination, deception, and retaliation in contracts and other dealings in meat and livestock buying and selling.
And this final rule will provide for a clear, more effective standard by which to govern all of this in the marketplace.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announcing on a Zoom hookup with reporters last week a final rule under the Packers and Stockyards Act, a rule designed to help even the playing field for livestock producers in their contract dealings with large consolidated meat packers.
It's going to help producers receive protection against packers, swine contractors, and live poultry dealers who may be trying to terminate them on a pretext. For example, claiming that a poultry termination is on animal welfare grounds, or perhaps refusing to deal someone because they say their cattle quality is poor when it's not.
Vilsack later told a meeting of the President's Competition Council at the White House that the new rule, along with other steps the USDA is taking, will enhance market integrity and transparency and will help protect producers against unfair practices, to which President Biden asked,
"What kind of a response you're getting from farmers?"
Vilsack's answer,
"Mr. President, they welcome these changes. For far too long, they felt that they were at the mercy of a relatively small number of integrators and processors. So to the extent that they now have more options to be able to process their cattle at local and independently owned processing facilities, some of which are farmer owned, to the extent that they know that they have a balanced playing field, that they understand better who they're doing business with, they understand that they have certain rights, that they can, in fact, seek a better deal. All of that, I think, is something that's been very much desired in the marketplace across all farm groups and across all associations. So this is very, very popular with farmers."
And Vilsack said USDA is working on a couple of other rules that also will boost competition in the livestock market, aligning with President Biden's view on this subject.
"Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism, it's exploitation."
In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Researchers are working to better understand chill accumulation in pistachio trees. Nut crops breeder at UC Davis, Pat Brown, described how they're trying to get more information out of individual winters.
"It's to go in many times during the winter and cut dormant sticks and force them to break bud in a controlled setting. So in a greenhouse or a growth chamber where they have heat and light and water and we know what the temperature is, we take the sticks out of nature and we can ask how close they are to breaking bud or flowering. And so if we don't do that, we basically get one data point a year. If you let nature take its course, an orchard is going to bloom on a certain date or a certain range of dates. And so what we're doing is, I think, milking more data out of every season by going in multiple times over the winter, cutting sticks and seeing how close they are to flowering."
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's raised its fiscal year 2024 agricultural export and import forecasts. The latest forecasts maintain the estimate of a $30.5 billion U.S. ag trade deficit, even after raising expectations by $1 billion for both imports and exports. Fiscal year 2024 exports are projected at $170.5 billion with increases in livestock, dairy, and grain exports. Conversely, oilseed and product exports are reduced due to heightened competition. Imports are forecasted at $201 billion with notable increases in beef imports. Congressional lawmakers have expressed concern over the growing trade deficit, urging proactive trade policies to enhance market access and expand exports. Despite concerns, USDA anticipates the agricultural trade deficit to decrease in the near term, reaching $14.7 billion by 2028. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is launching a new office to expand engagement opportunities with agricultural and rural communities. The new Office of Agriculture and Rural Affairs aims to involve farmers and ranchers in environmental efforts while supporting small towns. The office will collaborate with existing agriculture policy advisors nationwide and coordinate with federal and state partners such as the U.S. Department of Agriculture, U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and state departments of agriculture. It will reportedly focus on science-based solutions to protect the environment and support agricultural productivity. Additionally, it will work with underserved rural communities and house the EPA's Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Federal Advisory Committee. The announcements received praise from the House Ag Committee ranking member David Scott and the American Farm Bureau Federation, highlighting the importance of involving farmers in environmental conversations. Industry engagement is being sought for a project to benefit the grape and wine industry. The project titled Enhancing Regional Grape and Wine Production and Quality is seeking input from stakeholders across the U.S. The project aims to better understand issues impacting viticulture, enology, and winery business management. A voluntary questionnaire has been created to engage with industry members and hear about concerns and issues they're facing. The survey is the first step in a research and extension planning project supported by the Specialty Crop Research Initiative Program. The responses will be kept confidential and all data gathered will be aggregated and used to assist the research team in providing the industry with new resources and information. Industry members willing to participate will have until March 29th to complete the online survey. A link to the survey can be found at agnetwest.com. UC Agriculture and Natural Resources is hosting a Vineyard IPM Day next month in Stockton. The event is scheduled for Monday, April 1st at the UC Cooperative Extension San Joaquin County office. Registration opens at 7:30, and the first presentation on powdery mildew and bunch rot management from Dr. Akeef Eskelin will begin at 8. Other topics of discussion will include what to be on the lookout for with spotted lanternfly and how to use weather stations to understand and respond to disease pressure. Following the morning break, there will be presentations on sprayer calibration to maximize efficacy, vineyard trunk disease management, and remote sensing on grapevine leaf roll virus detection. Madeira Viticulture Advisor Dr. Carl Lund will also be going over vineyard soil pest and disease management. More information on the Vineyard IPM Day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com.
Finding new trade opportunities in South Korea. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Representatives from 49 U.S. companies and organizations are headed to Seoul, South Korea this month for an agribusiness trade mission. It's led by USDA's Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexis M. Taylor, who says she's confident the mission will produce great results. South Korea ranks as the United States' fifth largest single export market. It's one of the fastest growing economies in the developed world and has been for the past several decades. With relatively small amounts of arable land, South Korea relies heavily on imported agricultural goods, especially meat and bulk commodities, to satisfy food and feed demand. While on the trade mission, participants will engage in targeted business-to-business meetings and site visits to build new trade possibilities, strengthen existing partnerships, observe U.S. products in the marketplace, and discover the latest Korean consumer food trends. The trade mission takes place March 25th through the 28th. Welcome back. Here's Chuck Zimmerman.
A commodity classic. I'm visiting with Christy Schrader with GHX. And would you, first of all, Christy, tell me what you do.
Christy Schrader, GHX Marketing Manager for Syngenta.
Well, tell us a little bit about the way that GHX is changing the seed buying experience.
Yeah, for decades, farmers have purchased the seed the same way they always have. And farmers have really seen that they're, you know, frustrated with the games and gimmicks that come with the seed buying experience. And GHX provides a straight-up seed buying experience by ensuring that GHX specialist or GHX certified advisor is partnered with them to ensure that they're maximizing profitability on each and every acre.
So what are the ways that you're making that a better experience for them?
So first of all, with GHX, key differentiator with GHX is the MaxScript. The MaxScript really takes Golden Harvest products, that have been backed by data analytics to ensure we get the right product on the right acre at the right population at a flat per acre price for no additional charge based on population, supported by the service from our GHX specialist and certified advisor. And again, this helps support that maximum profitability on each and every acre.
Since we could say that profitability is part of sustainability definition, when it comes to what farmers are trying to do and with seeds like yours, is that something that can help them be better at those things?
Yeah, so Syngenta is dedicated to the R&D and sustainability, but what we look at with GHX is really focused on differentiating the assurance programs with GHX that are different than other seed companies out there. First of all, we have AgriClimb, which is a risk assurance program that really gives our farmers the peace of mind to know they're protected with adverse weather, which is something we know our farmers can't control. Also, GHX provides Golden Advantage 0% extended terms with the financial volatility that many farmers are seeing. So this is another way GHX is really differentiating themselves and making the seed buying experience different and better for our farmers.
What else would you want growers to know about GHX that we didn't touch on?
First of all, GHX app is available to all corn and soybean farmers. Previously, we were only accessible to the million acres that we have available right now with our GHX customers, but the GHX app is available on Apple and Google. But what we're really seeing with the GHX app is bringing all of the business features that farmers are challenged with compiling in one-stop shop, whether that be transparency in billing, transparency in financing, the MaxScript ensuring they have the right products on the right acre at the right population. All of that is combined with the GHX app. And again, this is for no additional cost, and we really see this as a key differentiator to GHX for our farmers to maximize that profitability on each and every acre.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Christy, for visiting with me here. We're at Commodity Classic. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
Do you want someone else to do your yard work? Gary Crawford has this report with tips from an expert on hiring a lawn care company.
Oh, finally, it's working. I finally finished now. I got the lawnmower out and ready for the spring and summer season. Now all I have to do is the spring fertilizing, the spring aeration, the grass reseeding. I think it's getting a bit too much for me. I think finally, and I have threatened this before, but finally this year I'm going to hire a company to do it for me. Maybe you're in the same boat, finally ready to hire a lawn care company.
Here I get people all the time calling me wanting assistance with their lawn service contract or tree and shrub contract.
That's Dennis Patton. He's an extension lawn and garden expert at Kansas State University, and he says first, we should not hire any lawn care company or sign any contract or agree to any type of service without doing some research on lawn care practices ourselves first.
I know you hire a lawn service because you want someone else to do it for you, but I would take enough time to learn the basics of lawn care so that when I go out and get a bid or contract for service, I make sure they are doing recommended practices that's going to be best for the long-term health and care of my lawn.
But then how do we find out what's best for our particular area? Ha ha ha, you know the answer to that that I'm going to give you if you're longtime listeners. Patton says, yeah, get in touch with your local extension service office, and there's one in practically every county.
They have this plethora of fact sheets and information available to help you learn the recommended practices for your local area, because they do vary a little bit from each part of the country based on climate, those type of things.
So, for example, timing, type, and amount of fertilizer might be different for different areas. Also, do they mow even when the yard doesn't need it? Do they mow at the right height for your situation? If you know yourself what should be done, then it's a lot easier to know if that's what the company would do or is doing. Now, after you know what the right answers are and you get the right answers back from potential companies, well then...
I would start looking at price, level of service, those type of things. But I always recommend people start to make sure they're doing the right practices at the right time when selecting a lawn service.
And also, of course...
You know, have them tell you what they're going to do. Send in pictures, get some references, follow up. And if they're doing incorrect practices, I tell people, you know, get another lawn service. It's time to move on because it's your money, it's your time, it's your landscape. You want to make sure it's done right.
And that the company's not doing unnecessary or even harmful things that you are paying for. In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Land values look to have a different market situation in 2024. David Geiger has this report.
The land market starting in March is certainly not as warm as this winter has been. According to Doug Hensley, the president of real estate services with Hertz Farm Management, he says the slow grind lower for corn and beans has farmers around break-even cash flows in the 2024 crop year. And looking at South America, he thinks there will be a lid on commodity prices as well as farmland values. Hensley says interest rates are also causing problems with the land market, especially comparing rates.
Historically speaking, our current interest rate environment is not out of whack or even high. But when we calculate land payments with a 7-8% rate versus those with a 4-5% rate that we were enjoying 2 years ago, the difference in those numbers adds up pretty quick.
Hensley says there is enough cash and liquidity, but also more selection going on. That means for the first time in several years, there looks to be pressure to the downside.
Across the market, there have already been several no sales from auctions that didn't perform quite the way some sellers had hoped. And while there's still plenty of capacity in the market to pop off a strong sale, just like we witnessed with a $29,600 an acre sale in Northwest Iowa here a couple of weeks ago in late February, those incredibly strong sales are likely to be the uncommon exceptions versus a rule in this changing market.
Hensley advises folks to watch for sale volume from neighborhood to neighborhood.
In those areas where little is sold, there's a natural potential for more strength in any upcoming sale that does occur because more local capital is still available to compete when something of quality comes to the public market. And in those areas where several farms have already sold, the potential for weakness is actually more likely for those opposite reasons.
And for the first time in 3 to 4 years, Hensley says other sale methods will compete with public auctions.
Make sure any farmland professional you talk to about a sale is giving proper consideration to all the sale options, because in a market like we currently have, the wrong method can potentially be very costly.
Again, Doug Hensley, president of real estate services with Hertz Farm Management. I'm David Geiger reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has today's featured interview.
Assistant State Conservationist with USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, Brandon Bates, joins us here today to talk about the Conservation Stewardship Program. And now applications are still being accepted. But Brandon, for those that might not be aware of the program, let's start out here with some of the details about how CSP works and some of the practices that are involved there as well.
The best way I try to explain CSP is, of course, first understanding, because most people know and understand what EQIP is. Of course, EQIP, our Environmental Quality Incentive Program, is designed, which is our flagship program, is designed to address actual quantifiable resource concerns. So what CSP does, it helps as, you can say, as a sidekick to EQIP to help take it even to the next level. So you may not have a actual resource concern or actual need, but you want to enhance your operation and take it to the next level. So it's initiating the producer to take steps to improve the condition of the land and to help them meet their goals. Through CSP, we provide technical and financial assistance, of course, to help them take it to that next level. Some examples would be when you look at what CSP is that stewardship piece is already looking at what you're doing out there on the property. And for example, that you may be already implementing a cover crop on your property. What CSP is, we will look at already giving, we'll first give you credit for already doing your cover crop, but also what can we do to take it to the next level, whether that be incorporating a multi-species or a pollinator habitat. It's just, again, taking it to the next level. If you're a rancher in range country, and of course, fencing is very important, but if you're in an area where you have a lot of wildlife, instead of using the top and the bottom wire as barb, you may look at it doing a smooth wire, which we call a wildlife-friendly fencing that makes sure that animals that are able to jump over and go under without being, you know, stuck and scratched or stabbed from the barb. So again, it's not, so CSP is designed not necessarily to, and which, well, let me back up. It can address resource concerns, but ideally it's first off recognizing you being a good steward of the land and what you're doing, but also how can we take that to the next step through in what we call enhancements that take you to that next level.
And as this is kind of a cousin program of sorts to EQIP, are people that are involved in EQIP eligible for CSP, or is it a one or the other type of deal, or can you be involved in both simultaneously?
So majority of our clients for CSP are former or active EQIP program participants. So that's where the majority we give our we get our people in CSP. They have already worked with us in the past in EQIP. Even though it's not a requirement, you don't have to go through EQIP to sign up for CSP. But they, like I said, they do go hand in hand in a lot of ways. So again, where EQIP is addressing a specific resource concern, CSP is just trying to enhance what you're already doing and taking to the next level.
And part of that, making those applications and getting that information in, I know the NRCS has quite a few resources available and staff available to help walk people through this process in terms of eligibility, what ducks they need to have in a row. How does that process work there?
As NRCS, we work hand in hand with our sister agency, FSA, a Farm Service Agency, which is the holders of eligibility for a majority of USDA programs. So in most offices or service centers, FSA and NRCS are located in the same building. So it's necessarily regardless if they come in with us and we walk them across the hall and get them set up with FSA, but also it happens the other way around. Individuals come in with FSA inquiring about conservation programs, and of course they bring them over. So our process, of course, we work hand in hand with FSA. So the first off, we need to make sure that they have farm records established, and that's where FSA comes in at. And we call it making sure they're in the system. Once they're in the system, we're able to pull up their property on in our farm and track numbers, but also look at developing the actual application and the contract. So that eligibility piece is very important, making sure that both the applicant and the land are both eligible for the program, or necessarily all USDA programs.
And then this is an especially good year for those that might not be familiar or want to continue on with some of their work that they've done in the past with CSP, because there's quite a bit of funding support behind the program this year, right?
Correct. We're in a great spot right now when it comes to conservation the past couple of years, and also looking at the next 3 years with IRA, Inflation Reduction Act. It has jump-started our program and pretty much almost doubled the amount of money we have available. So the opportunity is there. I know when the IRA first came out, it was talked about a generational opportunity for conservation and farming. And of course, we're just trying to be part of it. And with this influx of new money, of course, we're trying to make sure we get the word out and hopefully increase our numbers in both obligation and application numbers.
Very good. And just some more information about the program itself. If you do get signed up and you are participating in the program, how long is the duration for this, and how long are some of these practices expected to be kept up as part of the program here?
So the CSP program is a 5-year program where we look at, there are payment limitations on called payment caps. So for most individuals, unless you're a joint operation, you're looking at payment limitations of $40,000 annually or $200,000 per contract. Again, unless you're a joint operation, and then of course that increases. So it's basically upon the individual or the entity. Again, unless you're a joint operation, then it pretty much in essence doubles the amount you're able to get. So through CSP, you're able to do both practices, which are direct practices where you may be, again, addressing a specific need, or you're doing enhancements. And each practice or enhancement has a practice lifespan, and it just depends on what that practice may be. Whether if it's, say, putting in an actual structure for water conveyance or wherever that may be, you may see a practice lifespan, which also includes operation and maintenance, that could exceed 10 to 15 years. But again, that's dependent on the actual practice that you do. Some of our agronomic practices, of course, only have to withstand 1 year, of course. That's that one growing season. And of course, making sure that it did take, the practice did what it was supposed to do, And then, of course, that's the lifespan of that practice. So it just depends on what the practice is, or practice or enhancement being installed.
Very good. So lots of opportunities there to see what might work for each individual operation. And just lastly here, for people that want some more information or want to know how to get started, where can people seek out information on the program and maybe an avenue to get signed up? And what kind of deadline are we looking at here?
I always tell people this is my first answer is because we are an agency of people and our job is to communicate and help everyone. So the first thing I always tell people is locate your local service center and come in and have a conversation with and talk with us. So you can also visit farmers.gov. So farmers.gov is a website that will give you information on all the USDA programs, including NRCS. But most specifically, of course, NRCS California has its own website with the programs tab for CSP and kind of goes a little bit more detail about what we're talking about and also provides fact sheets. So I would say first, locate your local service center and go have a conversation with them. Let them know what your goals are and what you want to do with your property. And we'll see which program is best and go from there. But also if you wanted to do some homework before going in, of course, you can go to farmers.gov or more directly the California NRCS website. And the application cutoff for first consideration as of right now is March 22nd. Just wanted to also point out that we do accept applications all year round for all our programs. But of course, due to workload management, of course, we have to have cutoff dates so we're able to process the applications that we did receive. And the first cutoff that is coming up for applications for CSP is March 22nd.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thank you, Brian. We will be right back. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now for more news. Did USDA's first look at 2024 total meat production show an increase over the previous year, which recorded a year-over-year production decline? Rod Bain tells us.
Last year was the first time since 2014 that total U.S. meat production did not record a year-over-year increase. Will that trend continue in 2024? As USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagum explained at this year's Ag Outlook Forum.
When we're talking about the total meat sector, we're talking about very, very small growth, less than 0.1%, taking us up to about shy of 107 million pounds.
In terms of expected production by meat category.
Basically, what we're looking at is declining beef and turkey production, but increases in pork and broiler meat. Most of these are not very large changes, with the exception of beef.
That due to the impacts of multi-year drought on cattle supplies. The expected decline in turkey production this year is associated with a period of weak prices and effects from a recent outbreak of highly pathogenic avian influenza the past few months. Turning to projected season prices for meat animals for calendar year 2024.
In terms of prices, we are talking about a record high cattle price of about $180 a hundredweight, which is about 2 to 3% higher than it was a year ago. Hog prices would be driven higher, largely supported by expected increases in demand, both domestic and international. A little bit higher poultry price, broiler price being driven by some increased demand in the U.S., offset to a lesser extent by some declines in sales overseas. Turkey, generally weak prices through most of 2024 being driven by demand. So we're looking at a double-digit decline in turkey prices.
Now, what about 2024 forecast for egg production and prices?
Basically, you're looking about 8 billion dozen eggs in 2024 compared to about 7.9 billion a year ago, and a very fractional increase in your hatching egg production. We are looking at egg prices averaging a little bit lower, down to about $1.83 a dozen, well below the high prices we saw in 2023, but still elevated relative to the years before the HPAI problems.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
U.S. corn is coming under more downward price pressure. Gary Crawford has more.
A quick summary of the general market situation for U.S. corn.
Relatively abundant U.S. and global supplies, price pressure, prices trending lower.
And U.S. corn exports running ahead of last season. This from USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jackanowski. Big supplies of corn around the world putting downward pressure on prices. And while USDA in its latest forecasts did not change the supply or the use numbers.
We reduced our U.S. season average farm price this month by 5 cents a bushel. Now it's at $4.75 a bushel. That's down almost $1.80 from last year. Last year's season average price was $6.54 per bushel.
So prices are projected down from last year by about 26%. Corn exports projected up by about 26%. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.